it's one of those very special nights in the year for me, in the year that I deliver this year. As I often mention, it's a marker of time. That it's hard to imagine that a year has indeed gone by. I stood at this bima to deliver this year a year ago. Pesach is a yomtiv which captures the imagination of Klal Yisrael. Like no other yomtiv and no other celebration. There's something just otherworldly and unreal about it. When you look at the psukim, the chumash, you know, our chazal interpret them, leads us to understand what the role of this yomtiv is in Klal Yisrael. What the roots of this yomtiv are. Torah writes in Parshas Boy, Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, as the Makif B'chayrus is too cold, the Mitzrim were overwhelmed. Vayikra L'moyshe L'yaron Laila, and Paro calls to them, Vayomer Kumu Tzu'u Mitoch Ami, leave, get out of here. Gam atem gam bnei Yisrael l'chu ivdu as Hashem kedaberechem. And the Medrash tells us l'lamei t'shayiparo doifik of hischon shal Moshe v'yaron. He came to knock on the door to rouse them from their sleep, from their observance of the Korban Pesach, I should say, to leave Mitzrayim. He insisted, kumu tzu, leave. And they told him, "Oshayta b'layla on a yaitzim." Are you crazy? Do you think we're going to leave in the middle of the night? Leave Mitzrayim? What type of mahalach is that? Amalem kumu tzu, leave. Is it v'chigano v'manachnu? Are we thieves that come and go in the night? B'boiker on a yaitzim. We'll leave in the daytime, as the Rabbeinu Shemaylam told us. V'atem lo seitzu ish mitpesach beiso ad boiker. Omar Rei Mesu Kol Mitzrayim, because the Rabbeinu Shalom said that there would be Makas B'chayrus, and in many homes there was more than one B'chor, because of the licentiousness of the Egyptians, so a woman had conceived from more than one man, and there was more than one B'chor. So when they saw this happen, they said, Kulon Omesim, we're all going to die in this plague. So they told him, Muvakish Ata L'chalos is a Makas Mimcha. So what do you want to do? You want to push this makkah off from you? We should assist you. So Emor Hareyatem. So Paro tells them Hareyatem Rishuschem Hareyatem Avodo Shalakavim Baruch. He tells them you are no longer enslaved by me. Paro, not only can he oppress them, he can't even get them to leave Mitzrayim either. You lock someone in jail, you open up the door, and you tell them leave. No, I don't want to. Well, tomorrow, tonight I'll stay in jail, it's fine, no problem. This is the ultimate disdain for his jailer. And on one hand, as we'll note, it was a night in a certain regard of trepidation. One wishes to escape horrific circumstances. The Rabbeinu Shalom has promised that it will come tomorrow. But how much does one sleep waiting for that tomorrow to come? A person that was stood in the port of Danzig on September 1st, 1939, and the world went up in flames, and a ship is about to leave tomorrow morning, September 2nd. He has all the right papers, he's going to leave. Did he sleep that night? He was anxious to see tomorrow come, to set sail, to leave this behind. And with all the anxiety they may have felt, the Rabbeinu Shalom said, Atem lo seitu ish mipesach beiso ad boiker. Not only wouldn't they go, there was nothing that Paro could do to pressure them to leave. And Paro takes a step back and he says, You're no longer. I have no authority over you whatsoever. I can't even get you to leave. The amunah that it took, the faith that one had to have, after all of those years of suffering, and the jail door is open, and the jailer implores me to leave, and I absolutely refuse. It's a phenomenal amunah. So when Paro stands before this amunah, he's overwhelmed. He says, you're no longer my avodim. You are avodim of HaKadosh Baruch. You've given yourself to the Rebbeinu Shlomo. I have no authority over you whatsoever. The very root, the first Korban Pesach, the first celebration of Pesach, is rooted in a people with absolute faith in the Rebbeinu Shlomo. The Rebbeinu Shlomo says, Atem lo seitu bishvi Pesach based on what baika. I'll stay exactly here. I won't move. An awesome amunah. Combined with that is what the next pasuk tells us. Amunah is significant, but amunah does not suffice. Pasuk tells us, this is pasuk Lamed Aleph, and it continues. The Tepzak Mitzrayim Alam, the Mayor of the Shal, Chom and Oret, Yom Rukulon Amayis. But till morning, they didn't budge. Vayisa, the morning comes, Vayisa, Amas, Bitzeiko, Eterim, Yechmots. They weren't eating dough. They had to take it before it became Chomets, because the Mitzrim did not let them even finish baking it. And then the Pasuk ends with a very, very difficult phrase. Mish'arei Som, Tzuroiz, Bissimloi Som, Al-Shechmom. And there are varied interpretations of these words. Rashi, citing the Mechilta, tells us that this portion of the Pasuk refers not back to Vitzeiko Terem Yechmatz, but refers to something else. Mish'areisa means Shiorei Matzah Umoro. The leftovers, the crumbs of matzah from last night's Seder, the shreds of the mor that were left on the table after the Seder ended, they gather these up, tzurois b'simloisam, they wrap them in their clothes, and al-shichmam, and they slung them over their shoulder. Why over their shoulder? So Rashi tells us again, citing the Mechilta, afo pisha behemos harbe holichu imohem, they had untold numbers of animals with which they left Mitzrayim, and all the booty of Mitzrayim they took with them. So what was the problem? To take this little package, a few crumbs of matzah mor, and to add it to the rest of their packages? What did they carry it on their shoulder? But b'chavvim hoyu was a mitzvah. They wanted the tircha, the exertion, the involvement in the mitzvah. They loved the mitzvahs that the Rebbeinu Shlomo had given them. These are the first mitzvahs that Klal Yisrael has celebrated, the mitzvah of Korban Pesach. And the chavivus, the love of the mitzvah, was such that they couldn't part from that mitzvah. When they left Mitzrayim, they couldn't leave the crumbs behind. And not only that, they couldn't even just pack them up as a memento and take them along. The mascarets, put them on the donkey, and that's it. We'll carry it along, you know. So 3 months from now, a year from now, we'll take it out to our children, and here's the crumbs from that Korban Pesach, that momentous Korban Pesach that we celebrated in Mitzrayim. But the chiv of HaMitzvah, the love of the Rebbeinu Shalom's mitzvah, was such that they had to schlep it, had to carry it over their shoulder. Gold and silver, that could go on the donkey. But the crumbs of the matzah mor, that's my most prized possession. That doesn't go on a donkey, that I carry myself. Amunah combined with chiv of HaMitzvah, with the love of the Rebbeinu Shalom's mitzvah, this is the yisoid, the very fundamental aspects of the survival of the nitzchias of Klal Yisrael. Amunah in and of itself does not suffice. Without Amunah we are nothing. The mitzvahs are nothing without Amunah. But if we merely have Amunah, we will not succeed. The Rabbeinu Shalom has granted us mitzvahs maisiyas, mitzvahs that we have to do. And if we articulate that Amunah by the fulfillment of the Rabbeinu Shalom's mitzvahs, then we've established the nitzchias of Klal Yisrael. And these two aspects were inherent in Klal Yisrael from the moment of the first Korban Pesach. This is the yisoid of this particular yontif. that the significance of the Yontif that we celebrate, not only in the precincts of the Beis HaMikdash, but we celebrate this Yontif in the most far-flung Golos that could affect Klal Yisrael. In foreign lands, on the foreign dominion, we celebrate Pesach just as well. Why? The Nesivos tells us in the beginning of his Akdoma, of his Perush and the Haggadah, that the promise that the Rabbeinu Shalom made with Yitzias Mitzrayim was that from all future exiles he would redeem us as well. This is part and parcel of the covenant that we struck with the Rabbeinu Shalom at the time of Yitzias Mitzrayim. So inherent in Yitzias Mitzrayim is the Rabbeinu Shalom's undertaking to redeem Klal Yisrael from any and all tragedies and exiles which will befall us over the centuries. So thus when we come to Pesach, Pesach is not only a celebration of that which was, of Yitzias Mitzrayim, of coming to Har Sinai, but Pesach is anticipating the future as well. If we look at the Seder carefully, the first half of the Seder discusses Yitzias Mitzrayim. The second half of the Seder, you have to look with candles to find. There are some mentions of Yitzias Mitzrayim, but they're secondary. The primary focus of the second half of the Seder, Yishvol Hamas Chalagoyim Asher Lo Yidoucha, Eliyo Anovi, the Gula HaSidah. But as Hashem, I hope that in the Shir on Haggadah, which we'll have, hope to have before Yom Tov, we'll come back, that the piyutim, all the piyutim, at the end of the Haggadah, Al Birhu Yivne Beis HaMakarov, which directly speaks of the Binyan HaMikdash, Echad Miyodeya, which is also pointing to the survival of Klal Yisrael and the Golos and towards our future. And finally, the Chagadiyah itself, which the classical Perushim will tell us is the entire cycle of Jewish history until Bias HaGoyim. The Seder is Benisim Nigalu or Benisim Nasidin Ligal. And the Rishonim that discuss in Chumash, that discuss the four cases. The four cases, as we know, Rashi cites the teaching of Chazal, Vautesi, Vitalti, Vudalti, Vulakachti, which refers to the events of Yitzias Mitzrayim. But the Rishonim also point us to four kosos or tarelo, four poison cups that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam will impose upon the Jewish enemies in the time of Mashiach. These are also symbolized by the Arba cases. Thus the Seder is Benis Nigalu, that which was, or Benis Nasid Nigal, that which will be. The Chasam Sofer, in a very beautiful interpretation, tells us, then what do we have? The Afikoyim, the matzah that we break in half. And we take the half that we broke and we put it inside a matzah cup. Or we hide it, we put it away. He says, this also is exactly the same dichotomy. The matzah that we have on the table is Lechem Sha'inim Alav Dvoram Harbei. We recite the entire story of Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim in relationship to that half of the matzah. That's the Lechem Oni, which is on the table in front of us. The second half of the matzah represents the Gula Asida, that which we will recite to thank the Rabbeinu Shalom for that Gula. But that's hidden, that's put away, because the Rabbeinu Shalom has not revealed his agenda and his timetable for that Gula. But according to the Chasam Sofer, this is the nature of the Lechem Oni, the Afikoyim. We break it, half is Lechem Sha'inim Alav, Dvorim Harbei of the past, and half is for the but that which we will thank the Rabbeinu Shalom for in the Gula Asira. Pesach represents the past, but we believe that the past in Klal Yisrael represents its future too. And thus the nobility which attends Klal Yisrael and Yitzias Mitzrayim, that is the nobility that we aspire to in the future. I'll end the Gemara has a dispute if in the nighttime tefillah should have the same should have the format that we actually have for it, or should have a different format. And the question revolves around, and the Shacharis tefillah is organized that after Shema, we have Gal Yisrael, and then we come to Shmona Esrei, because we have Geula and then Tefillah. In the night on Tefillah of Maariv, should it also be organized in this fashion or not? And Rabbi Shulman Levi said it should not, and he organized it differently. He had Shmona Esrei, and after the Shmona Esrei came the Brichas Kriya Shema, and Kriya Shema itself. Whereas according to Rabbi Yochanan, which is our accepted normative practice, Maariv is organized that first we have the Brachos and then Gal Yisrael, and this precedes Shmona Esrei. And the Gemara gives a number of explanations of what this dispute is about. And one of the explanations is that is the redemption which we experience in the nighttime in Mitzrayim, is that significant? The daytime experience, Va'atam lo seitu ishu pesach beisa ad barika, so when did we leave? At dawn, we left Mitzrayim. So that's significant, we left. The night before we left, is that also significant? We celebrated the Korban Pesach. We were waiting for daybreak to leave. Is that significant or not? Rabbi Shulman Levi said it's not significant. We were still in Mitzrayim. This is that's not something we should reflect upon. And Rabbi Yochanan said no. As we stood in Mitzrayim and we anticipated the next morning, our geula began from that moment, from the time we bring the Korban Pesach. And what this tells us is that even while Klai Yisrael is still in the Golus, and we can merely anticipate the Yeshua, that's also significant. And just as they stood, Pesach represented not only the Geula of the daytime, but the Geula of the nighttime, waiting in anticipation for the Geula to come. Pesach represents this in all the generations. When we celebrated Al Admas HaKodesh, it's of the actual Geula. When we celebrate it, Alad Mas Nechor, then it's a celebration with anticipation of the Rebbeinu Shlomo's Gula of Klal Yisrael. The centuries go by, difficulties go by, but Baruch Hashem, in ways that are totally wondrous to us and for reasons that we can't understand, Klal Yisrael survives. And we see in ways that we cannot comprehend. The Rambam says we will not comprehend these matters until we look at them retroactively. Until we, after Mashiach comes, and we'll look back, we'll first understand the words of the Nevi'im. But we live in an era when close to half of Klal Yisrael is zoicha to live al Admas HaKodesh in Eretz Yisrael. Then we know that we live, there's something, the Rebbeinu Shalom's processes are at play. How the Rebbeinu Shalom intends to play them out and in what fashion, we have no idea. We wait with anticipation. But the fact that the Rebbeinu Shalom's hand is at work in Jewish history is something that we cannot miss. It has nothing to do with politics. It's really an observation. Close to half of Klal Yisrael lives al Admas HaKodesh. That's something that the Rebbeinu Shalom has brought about. So we see that the processes of Jewish history continue. They remain as veiled as they were before. We do not know but the ultimate design, the timetable of the Rebbeinu Shalom. But we eagerly await them. And this is the significance, the special exhilaration that we feel in Pesach, is we connected with the nobility, with the freedom of Klal Yisrael, and full faith that we will again merit the Rabbeinu Shalom's Gula, that the Rabbeinu Shalom will redeem us. It's the sense of exhilaration that we have when it comes to Pesach. And this really informs the whole body of the Halacha. That's why, if we look at this body of the Halacha, not only in the Svarim, where we find it, but in common practice as well, there is no Halacha in Klal Yisrael which is as meticulously observed as the Halacha of Pesach. The shyness that we have, all the minhagim that we have, and all the chumras that everyone has, it's because we have a very special relationship with this mitzvah. We don't want, it is so special and so significant that we cannot risk the slightest chance of error. And therefore, it's built into the halacha and built into our tradition and common practice an extreme care and the observance of all the halachas. When it comes to the halachas of Pesach, we go off the charts. We even have a term for it. We call it Chumrah de Pesach. The special chumras of Pesach. We take a chumrah, they take a very stringent slant. And in case the shukrach wasn't enough, but Klal Yisrael has seen over the generations, they had its own traditions of chumras as well. And they're all kaddish, because they come from our extreme desire to observe this yontif in exactly the proper fashion. I want to take a look. As I told you, we do not believe in Klal Yisrael that Amunah itself suffices. Amunah is the Yisrael. But unless it's expressed in Mitzvah's Maisiyas, it has ultimately no significance whatsoever. Nothing will remain of it. It will fade away like the snow of last Shabbos. Disappear. Melt and disappear before our own eyes. Those parts, unfortunately, of our community which do not understand the necessity of Mrs. Maithias, so their struggle is continuity. How are they going to survive? And day by day, the demographics show us that they're not going to. Unfortunately, I cry. There's not a reason for me to rejoice. It's a reason that I cry. They will fade away. Because there is no Nitzchi. No nation in the world is Nitzchi except Klal Yisrael. And we are Nitzchi because we have Amunah, or because we have the mitzvahs that the Rabbeinu Shalom has given us. When we observe both of them appropriately, then we are Nitzchi. We are Lamailum and Azman above all circumstances of history. But only the Kedusha Yisrael and the Kedusha that the Rabbeinu Shalom extends to us, we can experience only through the Shmiras HaMitzvahs. There's no independent avenue to find Kedusha for Klal Yisrael other than through Shmiras HaMitzvahs, that the sole means that the Rabbeinu Shalom has given us. The special chashivas that we have to have for Mitzvahs Maisiyas, they're not something on the side, they're not secondary, they are the essence of the Kedusha that the Rabbeinu Shalom bestows upon us, is access dafka through Mitzvahs Maisiyas. This is the one time of year that all of us undertake to be a kosher supervision service. A whole year, you want to open a store in this part of town, you call a Devada Ravana of Queens and say, listen, I'm renting a place, it's trade until now, send me a few professional mashgicha, and they'll come and they'll spend a day or two there, they'll kosherize the place, they'll tell you everything you have to do, and you'll be in business. Comes Pesach, each one of us is in the kosher supervision business. So we have to oversee koshering our own house. Koshering is not an easy process. And I'll tell you a little secret, that koshering in the house is more difficult than doing it in commercial places. Commercial places have different type of equipment that you can handle differently. They are larger spaces. They do not have the types of things that we have around them. You don't have wood cabinets in commercial kitchens, all types of things that you have to be careful about for fire reasons and fire hazards, etc. They are designed to live and to exist under very harsh circumstances. So the harsh circumstances of koshering, plus professional hands that can use the types of equipment that one should not use in the house. I mean, one should not be using a blowtorch in one's house under any circumstances. For varied reasons. First of all, the environment is not safe for it. There are too many flammable things around. Secondly, the equipment is not really made. It's not commercial equipment. It's not made to withstand it. Thirdly, no one's a professional. Unless you're a professional in handling these devices, they are very, very dangerous to use. If you put a torch on a surface for a few seconds and you touch your finger to it, you'll feel a burn for, don't ask for how long. We forget the blister that you'll have, but it won't stop burning for maybe a half a day. This is not something that you take lightly. You have to be used to working with that type of equipment and know how to use it. Consequently, when we have to kosher in the house, it's a lot more daunting than in a commercial place. In a commercial place, if you have a small crack in something and you want to get it clean, you take a torch, and in 10 seconds, you achieve the highest level of kosher of leaving gomer. It's red hot, and that's it, and on you go. But you cannot use such methods in the house. So home koshering is indeed more difficult than commercial koshering. I want to go over the basics that we need to know. I will start, as I usually do, from the top of the oven, from the stove top, and for a very simple reason, that's the first thing that one really has to kosher before one does anything else. kashering necessitates having hot water. Now, how are we going to have hot water, which is kosher for Pesach, unless we kasher stovetop? So we have to start there. Now, it's not that difficult to kasher most stovetops. The biggest problem is not the kasher. The kasher is the easy part. The cleaning, I want us to clean it thoroughly. The entire, all the top surfaces, all the grates, wash off the jets. Basically, underneath, clean out the junk that fell down there. One doesn't have to go crazy about that because it's a one-way street. It's going to come down. It's not likely to come out again, but it's not very geschmack to have a whole plate of noodles down underneath the burners on paste. So you want to clean it out basically, but you don't have to go nuts about cleaning out down there. But the problem is first to get it clean. That's number one. Then number two is how to kasher the various parts of the stove itself. Now, fortunately, when it comes to the sink, as we'll see, we have to wait 24 hours and not use it for hot use before we kasher it. This does not apply to any time that we are kashering by the use of dry heat. The 24-hour limitation is a technical matter within the process of kashering itself. Because just as the water can purge the chametz from a kli, from a utensil, it could also take chametz and put it back into the kli as well. So how do we get it out without putting it back? This is the enigma of kashering anything. Now, there are two types of resolutions to this problem. One resolution of this problem is that if you have a head like Einstein, so then you can master all the intricacies of the Shulchan Aruch and all the technical requirements, there's actually a way to do it. But if you have a head that's a little smaller than Einstein, so then the Shulchan Aruch gave us a method that we wait 24 hours, and as we'll see when we get to it, then we don't have to worry about the problem. But when it comes to the use of dry heat, we can kasher within 24 hours of the time that we use the equipment. What? Yes. We'll come to the sink soon.
Sorry.
Now, basically, there are two forms of kashering with dry heat. One we call Liban Gomer, which means to turn something as a question if it means red hot. That's one of the views. And there's a second type of kashering, which we call Liban Kal, which means it's heated to the point that it would burn tissue paper or burn straw. And that's the lesser of the two. Now, for the stovetop itself, it's rather interesting that between the bottom line halacha, the Ikar Adin, what the halacha rigidly demands, and our practice, there's a significant gap. And part of that significant gap has to do with all the chumras that we accept upon ourselves in Pesach. If we look at it strictly from the strict letter of the law itself, without any addition of chumras to it, we would arrive at a very startling conclusion. And that is that if I went into a non-Jew's house on Chol HaMoed Pesach, and he cooked on his over stovetop, he cooked macaroni and chaza, okay, a pot of macaroni and chaza, not very appealing to us, no. Then he took it off, and I wiped it off, made sure the burner's clean, and now I came and put down my chicken soup with my kosher lepesach of knedlach inside, and I cooked it on there. From the strict standpoint that halacha, I could take it back to my house and eat it, and it's 100% kosher for Pesach. Right? That's the strict letter of the law. And the varied reasons for it, the principal reason, the simplest reason is, that the Yoredei addresses, why do we use the same burners for Milachos and Shleishos? Is because of the fact that the flame is there, it burns anything up, and we're not concerned that anything got absorbed. So that's the strict letter of the law. Nevertheless, the Ramah tells us common practice has emerged that we don't rely upon that for Pesach. And in between, even between Chometz and Pesach, we do what Liban Kal. And therefore, that's one of the reasons we are not super stringent in this particular Liban Kal. And the method that we use, now let me describe a few different types of ovens and a few different types of circumstances. You can have a good old-fashioned gas range. A good old-fashioned gas range is very simple. You wash everything. You wash the drip pans, well, grates. Then take aluminum foil, but listen very, very carefully. Cover one burner at a time. Not the sides, don't drape it over the sides of the grates, just over the top of the grates, and even tent it up a little bit. Put on the flame high enough that it's just below the aluminum foil, that it doesn't strike at the aluminum foil. And basically, leave it for 15 to 20 minutes, and that achieves Liebenkalt, that amount of heat. Now, after you finish with one, close that one, go to the next one, to the third, to the fourth, to the fifth, to the sixth, however many you have. Now, you may ask me that, why be so Polish about it? Just take a big sheet of aluminum foil and cover the whole oven at one time and turn them all up, and in 10 minutes be done. The problem is, if you try to do that, in 10 minutes you may be done with your oven too. When you put aluminum foil or blech over an oven, it traps a tremendous amount of heat. The materials used in this oven are not designed to put up with that amount of heat. And you could wind up ruining the enamel, for example, the enamel finish. It'll finish. It is not designed for such levels of heat. So therefore, do them one at a time, and you'll be happy. In a short amount of time, you'll be finished, and everything will be in good shape. Your equipment's not going to be ruined by it.
What if you have continuous grates? What? You have continuous grates. They're not four separate grates. You actually have one that...
Those are problematic. The ones that you have, for example, I'm aware. When I came to California, to Chaimeli's wedding, so one of the people that knows me in California, they were waiting for me to come, and they came and they picked me up, I think the night that I came, and they drove me over to the house because they showed me exactly this continuous grate. And I told them that what happens in this is you have two burners here, and then you have a grate in the middle. Now, that grate in the middle is not over a flame. And for that reason, I told them you cannot use that grate for milachic inflations. You have to choose one of the two. And when you cannot use it for milachic inflations, l'chatchila. It's better not to. There is another side hector for it, but I told them not to. I'm not telling you trafe. It's not going to be trafe if you did. But the biggest hector that we have is the fact that it burns. There was another hector, but the other hector was not as good as that hector, which I don't want to get into now to discuss with you privately. So therefore, the chatchila, you should not use it for both. That continuous. So let's see. If you have that for Pesach, you know, you can kosher it by putting it over the flame itself and doing the same thing with that particular grate. Just over the grate, not over the rest. Just make sure, don't make it larger than the grate. And don't pull it down on the sides. Over the top of the grate, and that's it, yeah.
Then
you're lucky.
You don't have to do that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now,
the
burner part doesn't need anything.
You got what you just described, which I have, so all you got to do is...
Just wash the burner and finish it.
I don't even have to bother saying what I'm saying.
No.
Oh, good.
That's all. Now, you can have other types of the, now, we'll come, I first want to discuss the burners, then we'll discuss the oven top. Now, secondly, you can have electric stovetop. Now, an electric stovetop is the easiest one in the world to kasher. As I told you, all we need is Liebenkalt, which is a minor burn. We don't need a major burn. Now, once something turns red hot, that's the max that you have to have for any kasher in the world. Now, if you put a electric stovetop on the highest setting, it usually starts to glow red after a few minutes. If it doesn't start to glow red, just take a piece of aluminum foil on, then you put it on, and within 30 seconds it will be red. And that's it. That's more, you overkill already. You've cashed it more than you have to. Close it, and go to the next one. So it is very, very, in minutes, you can kasher all the coils. If you have sealed burners, you can kasher really in the same way that you kasher the regular gas ranges. You can kasher them the same way. The problems arise in terms of what to do with the varied types of materials that we have on stovetops. Now, you can have, many of them have some type of enamel top. Now, enamel is not something, the porcelain enamel cannot be kashered. So therefore, one has to cover it. And either with very thick aluminum foil or two layers of aluminum foil, either way, so that it doesn't tear during Yom Tov. Now, there's no necessity to dump hot water on it. in such a place. And particularly, you should be careful if you have an electric stovetop, you should certainly not pour boiling water on it. Because if you get a little bit of water in the connections, the next time you put it on, they will blow. And it'll cost you between $100 and $150 for each switch to get it fixed. So that's, I don't think you want to be doing that. Now, you might want to take off the handles and clean them very well, maybe soak them in a little ammonia. If the buttons come off, also from an electric stovetop, take them off, soak them in ammonia a little bit overnight, wash them, dry them, and put them back once they're duly dried. And then you won't have problems with them. But the stovetop you should cover. Now, you can have the third type. You can have a stovetop which is made of a stainless one, a metal one. But the truth of the matter is, there's really not a good method of koshering it. Because even though stainless metal can be koshered by dumping hot water on it, but this heter does not apply to stovetops. And the reason is, since on a stovetop, one typically pulls hot pots off the fires and puts them around the sides, and the hot pots come in contact with the stovetop, any place where a hot pot comes in contact with, one cannot kosher by pouring boiling water on it. Now, there is a method of koshering these type of places, but the method of koshering is not safe for home use, not especially not under our circumstances. Basically, what you have to do is take a brick and heat it till it's very, very hot, then pour hot water, and then run over all the places where you just dumped the water so that the water sizzles. Not a very safe practice for one's house. So therefore, even if you have a metal top oven, you should also cover it. Now, the third possibility, and this I don't have any answers for. The only answer I could have is that you should get something else for yourself. That is, if you have a glass top, the glass tops are very, very hard to kosher. The glass tops are very sensitive to heat. And as I've mentioned before, I went to visit one of my Chassidish friends in Borough Park once, and he showed me, he put on the blech on one of them, and he literally had thousands of pieces of the stovetop by the time Shabbos ended. The thing just disintegrated. Just disintegrated into little tiny shards of glass. So it is not made to be used in such a way. So I cannot tell you how to kosher such a thing. And there are two problems. There's a practical problem of how to kosher it, and there's a halachic problem too. The halacha states that any piece of equipment that I'm concerned may become damaged in the process of koshering, I'm not allowed to kosher because I may fudge it. Before I complete the koshering process, I will stop it so that it shouldn't get damaged. And therefore, the halacha specifically states that if there's concern that a piece of equipment shouldn't get damaged, then I have no right to kosher it in the first place. So I do not have any aces for glassed up stoves. I cannot tell you what to do. I do not know a way which is practically safe, and I don't know which way which is halachically safe to do this. Now, once one is koshered, now on the stovetop itself, the drip pans, the ones, not the ones underneath, but the ones right around the burner itself, either have different ones for Pesach or cover the ones that you use on the stovetop, because again, they cannot be koshered fully, and cover them fully and put them back on. Now, then one has reached the point to have a stovetop which is kosher. If I have a stovetop which is kosher for Pesach, so now I can take out a Pesach kettle. And I'm very partial to kettles. I don't like the use of pots of hot water. Pots of hot water are something which is very, very dangerous under all circumstances. You carry around a pot of hot water when there's very little control over when that water comes flying out and how much and in what direction. A kettle is designed that to keep the hot water in except when you want it to come out. And you can pretty much readily control exactly where it's going to come out and what speed and where and when. So use kettles. Do not get involved with putting up pots of water. Hypothetically, they're good, but practically, they are very, very dangerous to use. So once one has kosherized the stovetop, then we bring out all the Pesach kettles. And we run usually around three at a time in my house. And one goes to the sink. Now the question is, well, again, what is the sink made of? So for the purposes of our discussion, the sink is made of one of two things. And then there's one, and there's two, A and B, as I will describe. Number one is assuming that it's a typical enamel sink. It's not a stainless sink. And an enamel sink, as I mentioned before, you can't really kosher an enamel. I do pour hot water over every part of it anyhow, and then I cover it. And a covering can be, I use aluminum foil, you can use one of these inserts you buy in the hardware stores. I kosher it anyhow, just in case, by some odd chance, something should come in contact with it on Yontif, I have a tzad lehokel that it's not necessarily a problem of chametz. That's the reason that I dump hot water on it. Now the drain itself, one has to kosherize, and I do that, first of all, I dump something caustic, or bleach or ammonia, or something of that nature, one of them, down the drain. Because if one opens up the drain, you could have last night's macaroni down there too. And I don't want any of that coming up on Pesach to make sure that it's no longer royal achilah. And I dump some hot water down too. Now, I did mention before that before you kosherize a sink, you have to close the hot water for 24 hours before. Now, you can do this the stressful way and the non-stressful way. So that's, everyone has a choice. If you want to do it the stressful way, you put up a sign over your sink, nobody used the hot water for 24 hours. And then about 23 and 3/4 hours later, you'll call me up that somebody just put on the hot water. That's the stressful way to do it. If you want to do it the non-stressful way, no, I don't think so. Self-flagellation is not a Jewish meter. Now, if you want to do this practically, you don't have to close all the hot water in the house. Almost all sinks are made with check valves. Go under the sink, close the check valve for the hot water for 24 hours. Or a second possibility, and that is my son removes the faucet from the hot water. So that's it. This is his patent. He doesn't want to bother with the check valves. They get stuck. They're hard to close. So he takes the faucet off, turns it a screwdriver, takes it off, and finished. That's it. Nobody's putting on the hot water for the next 24 hours. End of the problem. This is a non-stressful way to do it. Then you know it's going to be for 24 hours, in all probability, that nobody's dumping any hot chametz into it. Now, then you can kosher the stove, the sink. Now, if you have while you're at it, you want to kosher the spout as well. So the spout gets chametz stick. We pour out chametz sticky things, spaghetti, the water, as we drain spaghetti, etc., and other chametz sticky things that are hot directly from a kli rishon into the fire. Inevitably, at some time during the year, we splashed the spout as well. So we should dump hot water on the spout, including dumping water up, throwing water up on it. Now, just let me go back one step. When you're filling up your kettle in the first place, you can fill it up with cold water, even though it's non-kashered. Now, when you're kashering it, on most four spouts, have an aerator, which directs the water down in a nice flow. They're usually removable. If it's removable, unscrew it before you kosher it and replace it for Pesach. So it's cost about approximately $1 in the hardware stores. And it does have some parts which it's preferable not to kosher for Pesach. If it's non-removable, you can leave it there and you don't have to worry about it. Now, you should cut...
Even if parts are plastic.
Since most of the spout is metal, Ramosha was made to go bus a race. But if you can remove it, you remove it. If not, not. Now, you should kosher the bottom too by splashing some water up from the kettle on the bottom of the spout as well. Now, to kosher, if you have a stainless sink, there's 2A and there's 2A and 2B. So let me do 2B first, and then we'll do 2A. 2B is that if you, general practice is to put hot pots at some time during the year, you take them from the stovetop and you put hot pots down on the sink itself, not on a rack, but on the sink itself, then you can't kosher in this particular fashion. So, if you don't put down hot pots, then it's very simple. Then you take hot water and you pour it slowly over every inch, so the stream should directly hit every inch. That's not going to happen with one kettle. It's going to take a good number of kettles. Because if the hot water, for example, hits here and then it runs down here, that's not irreclamation. Irreclamation means a direct pour from the kettle on each spot. Now, if you have a stainless one and you don't put pots down upon it, you can pour hot water all over it. And when you finish, it's 100% kosher for Pesach and you don't need a sink liner. If, however, you put hot pots down in it, so pouring hot water does not suffice because, as I mentioned before, wherever you put hot pots down, then you need what we call the Evan Malubin, the heated stone. And that is not very safe to use. Now, some people have bought a very expensive immersion heater. They tell me it costs $60 to $70. That's what I heard recently. which you can put in the sink and boils the water while it's in the sink. So therefore, that's fine. And then if you did that, you don't have to cover it, even if you put hot pots down during the year. If you don't have it, dump the hot water on it and then line it in some particular fashion. Now, if you have whatever stoppers you have for the sink during the year, obviously you're going to replace them for Pesach. You're not going to use the same stoppers in the Pesach Tikkun sink that you use in the Chametz Tikkun sink. Now, let's talk a little bit about countertops, because countertops are really very similar to that which we've talked about with sinks. For practical purposes with countertops, probably we should also put them in two categories. Marble, real marble ones, and all the other ones. If you have a real marble countertop, even if it has a seal, which all of them have to prevent penetration of stains into the surface to lessen its how porous it is, you can pour hot water all over it, and you don't have to cover it at all. If you put hot pots down on it, then you have the same problem that you have with sinks. So again, it depends on your practice. If you don't put hot pots on it, you can pour hot water all over it, and that's it, and it's kosher. I had to do initially, I was troubled with the sealer, if the one kasher with the sealer or not. And I asked for Scheinberg Schlitter this a good number of years ago, and he told me to kasher it anyhow for Pesach Lechatchila, even if it had a sealer. So not to be concerned about it. So that's normative stuff. If it's anything other than that, which is varied, it can be Corian has been rather elusive. It's a mixed material of groundstone and all types of other things in there. Whether it's formica, all of these things, none of them are absolutely, we kosherize them during the year, but we do not kosherize them for Pesach. And consequently, really all you have to do mitzad adin is to wash them well and cover them well. I happen to be, for the reasons of my own chumras, I dump hot water all over them again for the same reason, just in case anything should happen to touch it. So it was kosherized anyhow. But as long as you wash them and you cover them, then you're fine. Now, when you're dealing both with the countertops and the stovetops, you have to remember to cover the splashbacks. Because chametz comes in contact with them, it's even a worse problem when you're dealing with the stovetops, because the hot steam strikes there all the time. So you want to cover behind the splashbacks all around the sides of the stovetop. The hood is also a problem. You know, in commercial kitchens, the hoods stand pretty high above the oven. There's a lot of space in between the hood itself and the stovetops. Not in a home kitchen. They're pretty close to each other. And we have to be concerned that hot steam rises up from the pots and hits there. Now, once hot steam is going to hit there, it can just as well readily drip down right back down again on the pots. Now, before Pesach, this would not present itself with a problem in and of itself. And the reason for this being, the halacha has two ingenious safety valves which solve most of the problems of kashrus which arise throughout the year. And those two are the following. Number one is we have the rule of botel b'shishim, that as long as the offending food, the one that might render somebody else non-kosher is less than one, the 60 times as much. It's less than 1/60th, or not more than 1/60th of the food that it's falling into, so the food remains kosher. So if you drop a drop of milk into the chicken soup next Friday afternoon, la aleichem, yeah, but the chicken soup certainly has many, many times than one drop of milk, so the chicken soup in the pot, it's all kosher, and that's it. You can serve it Friday night in the china, and everything's fine. It's kosher the mahadran effect. Now, this is number one safety valve. The second safety valve we have is that if something wasn't used in the last 24 hours, for let's say I cooked a steak, and it was a clean pot which hadn't been used for hot milchiks in the last 24 hours, the steak is kosher. The pot needs to be kosherized, but the steak is kosher. The food remains kosher. So these are our two big safety valves which solve about 90-some-odd% of the problems that arise in kashrus throughout the year. The problem on Pesach that we have is that, number one, the first one universally is agreed to, doesn't apply in talks in terms of our talking halacha l'maisa. There is one view in Rav Chaydon that says otherwise, but in the Shulchan Aruch itself, Sfaradim, Ashkenazim, everyone agrees there's no din of bittul on Pesach, number one. So that's the first problem. No matter how small the amount of chametz that falls in, it still renders the food offer. So if I take a Pesach, like a Chometz, like a bencher, for example, and one crumb of that should fall into my plate of soup, the soup is offer, the plate may be offer, all types of things. It's a very, very severe problem. Secondly, according to Ashkenazic practice, there's a machlokus in Siman Tov Mem Zayin Sif Yud between Sephardic practice and Ashkenazic practice. But according to Ashkenazic practice, the heter that if something wasn't used in the last 24 hours, it doesn't render something also does not apply on Pesach either. And therefore, if I use a chometz tikka pot which hadn't been used for the last 24 hours and I cook something with it on Pesach, it's also unfit for use. That's why we have to be so careful with the equipment that we use to make sure that there's no problem. As an aside, I should mention, the Achrayim, one that listens to the Achrayim, to the Messiah of Klal Yisrael, is Me'usha. When we sometimes are wiser than the Messiah, we're a little bit too clever by half. When the Achrayim tell us we should put away the Chometz Tikka Kelim or put them away well, doesn't mean to leave them around. When we put them, either lock them up, or box them, tape them, cover them with sheets, so that it's obvious that one cannot come to make a mistake. If we don't do that, we may wake up with a rather rude surprise and realize someone took out one of the chometz tikka kelim by mistake from the basement or here or there and used them on Yom Tov too. A word to the wise. I've had such problems arise. Now, going back to sinks. So if sinks are used for hot pots, or they're made of enamel, and once you dump hot water in them, and cover the inside of the sink with whatever you want to cover it.
What?
If you, I'll tell you. If you think so, then you don't have to kasher it. In Tuf Nun Aleph, I believe, Sivov, the Bechaber paskins that it suffices to kasher something in accordance with its normal practice. I am not obligated to worry about unusual uses of this particular piece of equipment. The Ramah is Machmer, and the Ramah says that one should kasher to take into account both the principal use and secondary uses as well. However, the Chofetz Chaim does quote one of the Poskim, one of the Gedolei Achronim, the Beis Meir, who says that if, for some reason, let's say the equipment you can't use, the backup method, for example, let's say I could do Hagolah on this, but it will be destroyed by heat, or I can't kasher it with heat, so then I am exempt, he says, and I can just rely on the mechaber and use the do kashering for the principal means.
So,
what?
Like
do eruv. So if you think that you never did, you don't have to work. Maybe by some oddball chance, that's not a problem. Then you could be soimach. The Beis Meir says on the mechaber himself that it suffices. Yes, sir.
You have an instant pot for this, a filter for this, and a soap.
The soap, I think, dispenser one, you should dump hot water on it. Clean it out somehow to wash out whatever was in there.
So
then just dump hot water on the outside. Now, the instant hot to me is the same thing. I wouldn't use it for 24 hours before, and then I would run water through it, take it out, and dump water on the outside, and I would kosherize. What was the third thing you asked? The filter on the outside, the filters usually are made of plastic, I believe.
The
aerator. Oh, no, you're talking the spray.
Not the spray. You have a water filter under the sink, which comes out to another trap. Cold water.
I don't think that, you don't have to do anything with that. That's not a problem at all.
Well, with the hot water,
you should not use it for 24 hours. Run hot water out from it out, and then pour hot water on the spout as well. Not a problem. Wasn't the use for 24 hours, not an issue. And then dump hot water on the before Yom Tov. You're fine with these things as long as they get done before Yom Tov. Yeah, David. Yes. Don't even look at them for paper. I would not use it for Pesach either. They're usually made of materials. I mean, you cannot, in the home use, I would not bother with them. I would change them for Pesach. In commercial settings, we have certain materials with the equipment, etc. In the home use and the way it's used, I would not recommend. There's a lot of plastic involved in them. The ones in commercial settings are stainless, a whole different sukkah. Well, typically, the minhag is to change these things in the house.
You also mentioned marble countertop, right? But what about granite?
Granite, the same thing. I'm sorry. You have granite too. Yeah, you know. Real granite. Ain't no phenomenon. Yeah. Okay, now, what we need to talk about is the following. We need to talk about ovens. We haven't talked. Question?
The last class of my stove, which is on top of my oven, is the vents.
Yes. Let's talk about the vents. You do have to make sure punch holes in the vents. You have no choice.
In the foil.
In the foil, yes. Because that oven is not designed to be used safely without being vented. So you punch holes in it. Now, just in general, you have to be careful throughout the year if you buy a stove, in terms of where the stove, if you have an oven underneath and a stove on the top, you want to be careful about exactly where the venting is taking place. Some of them vent through one of the burners, so then you have to really be careful what you put on them. Some vent in the back, and you have to move the pots a little away from the back, but you have to be aware of where the vents are coming out and what you have, what pots you have on the top, and how they correspond with the pots that are underneath while you're cooking. Now, I want to talk a little bit about ovens. Now, ovens, for my purposes, again, come in two types. They come in self-cleaning types and non-self-cleaning types. Baruch Hashem, this problem is resolving itself over the years. Because basically in our community, every time someone replaces an oven, they buy a self-cleaning one. Nobody buys non-self-cleaning ones anymore. So therefore, all the daunting problems of koshering are pretty much, you know, resolved. You have to clean them. You do not want to try to self-clean a very dirty oven. I have a friend who, the night before Yom Tov, he put on a self-cleaning oven, full blast, and in short order he had flames shooting out of the vents. Because he didn't realize he had grease, a lot of gathered, collected grease on the bottom, and the grease caught fire. But fortunately, my friend is a meshuggah about gadgets. He loves gadgets. Don't ask. He has gadgets for gadgets for gadgets, not shayach. So among them is he had one that's very good to have, in fact, and that is that he had a fire extinguisher in the kitchen, which is a wise thing that anybody should have a fire extinguisher in the kitchen. And he took it out and he zapped the fire. The fire department came, the fire was out already, he had to clean up some soot, but the house was saved and Yom Tov went on. But you don't want that to happen. So you need to do a basic clean out before you start. Now you run it for 3 hours. If you have spots that are left, then you have to really apply ammonia to them and scrub them and put them on again for another 3 hours. That usually will take with very rare exception, will that not take care of the problem. Now the racks of the oven, you should also put in the self-cleaning for 3 hours. They may discolor a little bit, but they'll be fine. And then you don't have to worry, you can just use the oven uncovered. I'm not one of the machmirim about the doors. There are some machmirim about the doors. I am not one of them. But again, if somebody has, for whatever reason, wants to cover it, I have no objection, you know, to covering. I can understand all types of reasons. There's a little bit less heat. But that is not, you know, the overall issue. There's also an issue that there's glass there. Glass is not fully kosherable, but glass is only a small part of the whole thing. So, according to Rabbi Yishai, it is kosherable. So be that as it may, it's not a chiyuv, and it's not my practice. You know, I don't insist upon it.
You have to run through the self cleaning twice.
One time, if it didn't get clean the first time, then
what if it burns to a crisp?
That's it. If it leaves ash behind, ash is nothing.
Okay.
That's, you know, the white ash or dark ash. Ash is nothing. Carbon is not chametz. Yeah, I'm aware. So I say, if you want to cover it, fine. You don't want to cover it, also fine. You can leave it alone. You know, part of the cheshbon is somewhat, perhaps in Kabbalah Kachpolto, who says that anything, it got as hot as it gets in use. Besides, who says anything goes there and really comes back? You also don't know. So, yeah. If you have broilers separate broiler compartment underneath, you should wash them out well. And put the if you use the trays that you have in the broiler to put food directly on them, and you should take them and throw them into the self-cleaning at the same time you're doing the self-cleaning. Once the broiler's clean, put it on between an hour and a half, and you're fine. Now, if you have a non-self-cleaning oven, you should really do two things. First of all, you should use some type of caustic cleaner to spray it, and do not put your eyes inside, your head inside the oven. That's something very dangerous, and you could hurt your eyes, fast for sure. I would recommend for a few dollars to buy a pair of goggles and wear them to keep you safe. That's number one. Number two is after that you clean it out, which is not an easy task, cleaning an oven. But after it's clean, then put it on the highest heat for about an hour and a half. And it's as kosher as it's going to get. Your racks you should give to somebody else that has a self-cleaning, and they should do them for you for 3 hours. After all of this, you should still cover the oven inside. When I didn't have a self-cleaning when I first came to Kew Garden Hills, I took heavy-duty aluminum foil, and basically you form a big U, which starts and goes around all the way around the three walls of the oven. And then once you have that, you can put a tent on top of it to cover the top, and another piece on the bottom to cover the bottom. What? What you have to do is you have to use enough aluminum foil that you can form it against the tracks, tightly against the tracks. You know, press it that it's tightly against the track. And then once it's tightly against the track and it's smooth against the wall, you can get the racks back in. But, as I advise everyone, and as I was on practice when I had this problem, that I put the racks in before Yontif, and we don't take the racks out again until after Yontif. The pots go in and out, but the racks stay unmoved. Because if you're going to start moving the racks up and back, you're going to tear the new one and fall apart. Now, those are the basic. Now, microwaves, don't bother with them for varied reasons. First of all, you got to clean them well. Secondly, most of them are made of plastic inside, and you can't kosher plastic for yom tov. Thirdly, for probably $40 today, you can buy yourself a microwave. So why in the world bother? Now, I am in general, in today's world, in a different world, at a different time, in a different place, I'd have different things to say. But in today's world, to the largest extent, utensils, I do not believe in kosher. They're hard to kosher properly because you have to be 100% clean. That means all the areas where the handle attaches to the pot, to get them 100% clean in home settings is very, very hard to do. Commercial settings, take a torch, burn away. Now, home, domestic pots and pans are made with curled rims at the top. Whatever the reason, I guess they feel that they develop a sphincter that they look nice that way. But they also gather dirt in that seam, and you can't get it out. Now, if you put a torch to it, you'd burn it up. You'd also ruin the finish of your pots. You're not going to like the way they look. So it's really, there's no effective means of cleaning them out. For a whole year, we can kosherize them, because as I mentioned, we waited 24 hours, we're soaking in some ammonia. We'll see that it's pogum. We're not going to worry about it. Commercial pots don't have these type of curls. They're wide open underneath. They have rims, and they're wide open. There's no place which is not accessible in a commercial. That's why commercial has a whole different possibilities than home. So why? The third thing is, Baruch Hashem, we live in a time which is relatively economically blessed. For a small amount of money, we can get new things for Yom Tov. So it is certainly a hidah. In the Chofetz Chaim, Zecher Tzadik L'Vrocha wrote in the Mishnah Berurah, he said he didn't understand why people would invest money in beautifying the shuls. But to buy a set of Nevi'im to read from the Klach, as we have in our Beis HaKnesses, which was one of the motivations, was this, that I did it, because of the comment to the Chofetz Chaim, which is a kiyum in the halacha, why people won't spend money for that. We spend money for everything, to beautify the house and to make everything so nice for Pesach, etc. And here, this is a heder in the kiyum of the din itself. So why not be mahada? And it just doesn't add up in today's world. Now, I didn't think I would speak about the refrigerator yet. The refrigerator, you should wash out very well. Now, you know, everything depends, I guess, in translation. And some things get lost in translation. A guy came to me this week. Maybe it was the end of last week. I don't remember. Today's a little foggy at this time of the year. And he says he heard that I said that you don't have to wash the back of the fridge. I don't have to clean the back of the fridge. So I thought about it, and I said, listen, I never said such a thing. That I could tell you, and I would not say such a thing, because it makes, you know, no sense. Helmet splashes on the back of the fridge. Then I thought for a moment, and I said, I realized. Yes, I was talking about behind the fridge, that you don't have to pull it out from the wall. So in translation, it went from what's behind the back of the fridge, from behind the fridge to inside the fridge. You know? So, you know, you have to wash out the whole fridge. You have to wash the racks. There is a mila to covering the racks, because it's hard to clean them absolutely 100% thoroughly. I mean, if you want to, probably the best way to clean them thoroughly, take them all out, put them in the bathtub, and put with ammonia and soak them overnight. And they'll probably get cleaner than you ever saw them in your life. You know, that probably will get them 100% clean. But it's a mylon covering them, but it's not a chiyuv. If you clean them and you're sure that they're clean well, then you're not chiyuv to cover them. Yeah, this covering is not so good because it affects circulation. Exactly. So it's not such a big mylon, because the refrigerator only shoots cold air in one place, and that's why they make it with these open racks, not shelves. I think that I touched all the things that we have to know how to get the. Now, let me just end with the kitchen table. I also, really, all you have to do is to wash it well, cover it. The dining room table, you just have to cover well. I put down some cardboard, I put some plastics on it, something which doesn't allow liquid to seep through. Because of my chumrus, so I dump hot water all over the kitchen table to have a good time. I make a big flood in the kitchen, whatever it is, you know. But you're not really mechuyev to do it. What you do have to do is wash it well and cover it well. That's what you're mechuyev to do. Oh, hood, yes. The hoods, what I do in the house is I cover it. I put aluminum foil over it, and that's it. I cover the whole thing. So, what? So, including the bottom, I wrap it, we tape aluminum foil, and that's it. The entire thing is covered. And that's, I leave it that way too. So I don't use the vent for yontif, that's all. Well? What? We talked about it. It's a little bit safer to use tea kettles. So, I mean, I don't want to step your practice, tell you, but as I say, I discourage it for safety reasons.
Not as a handle of pot, it's a small handle.
I understand. It's the open pots of hot water, however, not so user friendly. I should mention the gaskets that you have around the ovens. You should clean in the crack around them. On your refrigerator, you should clean, especially on the top of the gasket, but all around where the gasket attaches to the refrigerator itself, a lot of dirt seeps in there over the year. And you should clean that as well. You don't have to cover it. If you want to, again, there's a mild, I can't tell you all the chumras to keep. The main thing is to wash it well, you know. Same thing. You're not mechuyev to cover it. No, you want to. But? No. Just wash. Oh. If, one thing you should be careful about, especially if you're not covering the shelves, is maybe the whole year we ought to be careful about this, but especially Pesach, is not to put hot pots into the fridge while they're still hot. You should let them cool off before you put them. What? If you put a trivet or something, fine. But you should not put a hot pot directly down on the racks inside on the shelf. Countertops are good. Yeah.
So
you're covered for mine. Yeah. The glass, same thing. Well, yeah, certainly you're not going
to
put on plastic hot pups.
No, you don't have to stop just cleaning
them. Just wash them. Those you can wash. Those have no problem because they're smooth. I mean, all types of linen that you use throughout the whole year, it's a very simple rule. If you can wash it and get it 100% clean without stains, you can use it for paper. If you can, you put it away and you use different ones. A simple, simple rule. Yeah, I don't think, just wash the outside, I think suffices, that's all. Yes. I would presume if you dump hot water on the outside of it, that suffices. Even though it's... Yeah, again, you can probably just wash it, because I don't think, you don't use hot, it's not a place to bring hot to the whole year. Yeah, true. How, where's the filter? On the top or?
Underneath,
underneath is not a problem.
So not underneath, like on the
sink. On the spelt, then you should change it. You should not leave it there for Pesach. Those have a lot of plastic in them, those things. Yeah.
Water cooler, are we allowed to use that
for Pesach? Yeah, I don't see a problem with
them. And if it has a hot
the hot has to be kashered by dumping, not by waiting for, by dumping hot water on it.
If it's plastic, it's still kashered.
If it's the whole thing is plastic, no. You cannot kosher.
Hot water, huh?
Yeah, but that hot water can have a lot of chametz. You can make oatmeal with hot water, too. Yes, you can kosher. Leave it for 24 hours. What? How are you going
to
move it around? If it's not made of plastic... Again, if this, most of the spray devices are made of plastic and rubber, and you cannot kosherize them for Pesach, so you can't use them unless you replace them. Most of the sprays.
You also won't have that much hot water. It's a small reservoir, it won't be enough
pressure. I'm saying it depends what is the outside parts of it. If it's made of metal, then they're usually ones that you just press down and they stay in place. Yes. So you just, if it's not, I mean that's the basic faucet itself. Just dump hot water on it, a little hot water, and that's all. Don't worry about it. Yeah.
I have a new oven now where I'm going to test it with pilot lights, and the fire is a little bit of wood cleaning. We have to, I don't know, what do you have to do? You have to turn off the...
With what?
The pilot light is always on. I'm not with the stove.
Don't worry about it.
You can still clean around.
You can clean, yeah. It's a big rig, so that's why you don't put your hand on it.
What about the little black thing on the burner?
Not a problem, just wash it, that's all.
Just wash it?
Yes. Ronnie.
The power of the sink that forced out, pulled out.
Yes. Monopoly.
Current makes steel burners?
Yes.
And mostly just
treat them the same way you do regular grain.
Isn't there a lot of dirt that gathers
underneath the position? You know, you usually have a grate or something on top of that, right? So that's all. You're not putting something on. So what's underneath is underneath. That's all. Just wash them and that's all. I wouldn't worry. Most of it is burned up probably anyhow. No, you do not have to move the refrigerator out, you don't have to move the stove out. You know, I have a very good suggestion. I don't know, I don't know if Claudio wants to adopt it. I'm not sure. We'll put it up to a vote. We'll have a referendum. But so my proposal is that on May 15th every year, we give a big clap on the Bima, and we pull out all the stoves, all the refrigerators, and clean behind them and put them back then, you know. A safety about a month after Pesach ends, you know. Yeah, well, you want to get cleaned? Okay, May 15th, we should make the date, you know. That's my proposal. Yeah.
What happens if you have a metal thing that's cleaned with sink? You don't put a hot pot on it
for
many years, but you don't know what
to do. Oh, don't worry. Don't worry about it. It's Onyx.
You
didn't go, oh, you missed. You better download last week's shift. So download it. The Mark will provide it to you. That's a good question, but I just told you where to find reference the answer. I cover it and I dump off water, and just in case anything happens to touch it during Yom Tov for some reason. Yeah, sides, always, whatever. I'm nervous. That's all. You're not mechuyev. I'm not telling you to do it. I'm telling you what I do. No, you got to cover it. The table, you got to cover it. It's not kasherable. Yeah, whatever, cover a table that you use for chametz the whole year, you cover. Period. That's all. Yes. The sprayer? I don't use the spray at all. It's not really kosher. The parts in there are rubber and plastic. They're not really kosher. I don't know. You're not mechuyev to cover it. You want to cover it? I have no objections to cover it. Yes, yes. Just scrub it well and it's kosherized. Yes, you can do that if you want. That's fine. I dump hot water from the kettle into the sink.
You don't run hot water at all?
No, I use cold water. Correct. So dump hot water from the kettle. Yeah. Doesn't make it, doesn't change it. No. Yeah. The story of papers later is like this. I think if you look in the OU book, I think there's, I forget who it is, so some of the agencies are Machmer, some are Meikle. The truth of the matter is they're all Mutter. They're all Mutter. If you want to keep everybody happy, don't use the cheap paper plate ones with hot. Use plastic ones if you want to keep everybody happy. The question is, there may be some kidneys in the starch, maybe, in the cheap paper plate. It's bottled anyhow before Pesach, and there's not an issue. But, as I say, if you want to keep everyone happy, whatever, the ones that are plastic coated, whatever, all of those use for cold, if you're going to use them.
Is there any need to wash the dining chairs?
Maybe, I don't know, maybe where you're sick, you want to clean off and say somebody drops the matzah on it on Pesach and picks it up. But you don't have to clean out in between where the leg and the cushion hit each other. No, you're not mechuyev. It's I didn't help you. You got to ask your place, your place of kachon. Yeah. No. No. Yes. Kid, yeah, it's fine for the bird. You're not, you know, as long as he.
You have to wash it out.
Yes, and make sure you feed him only kidney or some yonder. Millet is fine. Millet is kidney. You will add it. In general, you know, high chairs and those things, you wash and you cover them. You don't use them the same way you use them. Yeah, baby bottles, you shouldn't use the same ones you use. You should put away the chametz sticker ones and have clean ones. Baby formulas are generally kidney and don't have chametz, so you should wash them in the bathroom and not in the kitchen. So, you know, you don't want to pour kidneys into your sink. It's not the chatchila to do such a thing on Yom Tov. And Rabbi Yisai, what? Oh, this there's a couple of side announcements I have to make. Number one, I have the notes sitting here on the table. First of all, if you want to get all types of information about Pesach, reliable information, you have two websites that you can get it from. You can get from starkey.org and ou.org. For those that use the internet, you want to be machsh, you know, have as much kosher things going on with it as possible. For those that use the medium, if you don't use it, it's a different story. Now, number one, Number two, I have one of my chaverim is one of the big hunchos in the stockade, and we speak throughout the year, and usually before Pesach is one of the times that we speak. And I caught him in upstate New York today doing a pre-Pesach run of Chodesh Nisan on all the dairies that they use and the cheese plants that they use. They were scanning them before Yom Tov. And what he did bring to my attention is really an old point, but he saw that it's particularly notable this year. When you go Pesach shopping, examine every single package to make sure it says kosher Pesach on it. And that's for two different reasons. Number one is he observed where he is in Baltimore that from some of the wholesale shipments that came had unfortunately a few chametz sticker cases, or non-Pesach cases, mixed in with all the rest of the Pesach cases of goods. Now, usually stores tend to spot check. You come, you look at them, you know, you get hundreds of cases. You don't examine every single case. And after that, they all look fine. So that's it. You take them and you put them up on the shelves. So you need to examine things for that purpose. Secondly, there's always a problem this time of the year from now until Yom Tov, and I was just talking, in fact, to Mr. Wasserman earlier about it tonight, about this issue, and that is people come shopping, and one has to be careful not to do it, but on the other hand, one has to be careful not to be affected by it. People pick up something, and they decide, oh, this, they want it, then they realize as they're traveling around, this is not the one that they want, because they really want the Pesach sticker one, and this is the Chametz sticker one. So when they come to the Pesach sticker one, they make a trade. They put the Chametz sticker one here, and they put the Pesach sticker one into their wagon, and they go on. Now, the next unsuspecting consumer comes to the Pesach section and takes that can off and goes home with it. Now, this applies also, Rabbi, saying any food deliveries that you get. If you make an order from a caterer of any type, from a takeout place, examine very, very carefully each and every package of food that is the kosher of Pesach one. It has happened over the years and will continue to happen because of the similarities of packaging principally, that you can wind up, you made a Pesach order, and they'll send you a case of chametz sticker goods. It has happened. It's happened in the years that I've been in the Rabbanus, and I've had calls about it in the middle of Chol HaMoed Pesach. A guy looked at part of his Pesach order, and he discovered that he had chametz. So every you get a delivery, whatever it is, from whomever it is, examine it, each and every item carefully. Don't look at one and decide everything else is fine. Examine each package before you put it into use. We have, Baruch Hashem, we have the, you know, this, you know, during the winter time, we have the winter getaway in Rocking Course. I have to tell you, we have two phenomenal mashgichim there. Two phenomenal mashgichim. I wish that in every kosher establishment in the world, we had such two mashgichim as we have for the Rocking Course. Because of the fact that this place is normally not a kosher establishment, so therefore there's always the possibility that there's some leftover non-kosher stuff put away. It's inevitably going to happen. And they're always afraid that maybe a worker is going to take something out that he's not supposed to. So they have a very simple practice. There's always, from the old time the kitchen opens until the time it closes, there's a mashgiach in the kitchen. And every single package of food which is taken out by a worker is not allowed to be open to use until he brings it to the mashgiach and the rabbi checks it and tells him it's fine. Doesn't make a difference what it is. Nothing, not a single package of food can be put into use without going to the mashgiach. So here's the package, can I use it? That's the practice, Rabbi, so that we need. It's a good practice a whole year to look at these things carefully. How many times have people call me up? Yeah, I thought I was having a par of a soup, and it's fleishik. I thought it was a par of a soup, and it's milchik. I thought it was kosher, and it's treif. You know, these things have why? Because the hashgacha went off 90 days ago from this item, and I didn't realize it. So, Rabbi, especially for Pesach, with all the tremendous effort that we put into preparing for this Yom Tov, take the time to examine each and every package of food before one puts it into use. I had last year, someone called me, it's a Meister Shahoya. They ordered fish, the Yom Tov, from one of the filter fish, the loaves, the frozen loaves that you buy in the store. For whatever reason in the world, the vendor sent them like a half a dozen or a dozen pieces of fish from the chametz sticker ones, not the Pesach sticker ones, and they discovered this probably, you know, the second night or the third night of Yom Tov. Just a simple example that happened a year ago. I had a number of such shaylos last year. Chomodik shaylos, and what to do? Examine each and every piece of food. You can understand. Rabbi Yisai, let me wish you a chasson.
So, egg and milk products.
It's preferable that you buy them before Yom Tov, eggs particularly. But again, most of these is not really so relevant anymore because they don't come to market so quickly. What's milked or laid on Pesach is usually not going to come to market till long after Pesach. It takes weeks until it arrives. Rabbeisai, Chakosha v'Sameach, a good Yom Tov. I hope, Be'ez Hashem, I'm hopeful that next week on Tuesday we're going to have a share in the Haggadah. Be'ez Hashem. Yeah, yeah. Not a problem. But not.